Well, I can't believe it. After months of trying to coordinate our schedule, I finally have James Cassez on the line with me. Hello, James.
Hey, Jane. How are you doing?
Good. I mean, I think this is like 3 months we've been trying to organize.
It's true. With your schedule in mind and traveling and all that, it's been rough.
Well,
but I'm glad that we're finally able to talk.
Yeah, me too. I'm going to tell people just a little bit about you, but I think it's better maybe if you tell them about yourself. James, I met James at a clinic that I was doing in New York, and he's a psychotherapist, and he specializes in the treatment of trauma survivors. And he's part of the faculty at NYU, and he does all consultations and workshops all over the United States. And he has this really cool thing that I'm so excited to ask him questions about. It has to do with energy work with horses, and he calls it equine energetics. And so maybe, James, you can explain to people how you combine psychotherapy, equine-assisted activities, and principles of Zen Buddhism, and how you blend those techniques into your work.
Oh, great, yeah. Well, you know, the reason I chose equine energetics is because there's a whole field of something called energetic psychology. And energetic psychology really relies on the idea that, you know, our thoughts have energy, our feelings have energy, and we can actually work with that. So it's combining the kind of analytic work that is my training and what I teach at NYU with a kind of more energetic approach. So the approach that I use is an integrated approach, and by that I mean it's you might not immediately notice its component parts. So I like to think of it like, I like to think of it like a dressage rider. So when you see a really good rider and their horse, you might not notice what they're doing that's creating the situation. Like to the outside person, they may not see how they got the horse to do that beautiful half pass, but our work is similar in that. So we combine the kind of underlying clinical foundation that is researched and solid. Basically, it's brief treatment, so it's whether it's 1 day, 1 hour, or a whole weekend. And we combine the equine facilitated work. We put in actually interesting and fun activities that, you know, are just exciting to do. I like to do them. They're fun to have around, but also they have clinical significance. In other words, there's an opportunity to look at how you relate to the horse in a metaphoric way. So we combine that with the psychotherapy using the clinical application to say, for example, you're setting a boundary with the horse and the horse is giving you a hard time with that. And some people say, well, but I like when he's close to me. I don't want to set a boundary with him. It's nice to have them close. Well, then you start to think, well, what is that like in your life? And are there times that your boundaries are trampled on? And sometimes you invite someone in, but maybe you don't want them to always be that close. Is there a way to set that boundary back? So that's a way that we combine the psychotherapy with the equine stuff. And then we have the Zen principles that sort of infuse the whole thing. It's, you know, we have the principles of mindfulness, of non-attachment, and of being truly open to experience. And that's how I bring the spirituality in. It's not really a direct application of Zen as much as it is sort of an atmosphere of that mindfulness.
I mean, this is completely, I think, aren't you like the only person who's brought these different aspects together and brought it to the equine world? It sounds completely unique to me.
Well, I think I am the first person who I think is at this clinical level. So I was just speaking at the North American Riding for the Handicap Association's national conference in November, and we're seeing many more people being interested in psychoanalysis and its application to the equine facilitated work. But we don't really have anybody who combines, I'm a Zen student at the Mountains and Rivers Order here in New York, who has a Zen background as well as the NYU background. And I'm a Fulbright scholar. I've taught about trauma in the United States and in Brazil and internationally. And my work is really very strongly academic. And we haven't really seen that in the field, but the field is actually growing and developing so much that we're actually seeing more people like me join in. And I had a conversation with Leif Helberg, who wrote a great book called The Way of the Horse, which is really the first textbook about this kind of stuff. And she and I were talking about my contributing to her next book because they are trying to get more of this kind of clinical approach in the field.
Wow. Yeah. So, I mean, in your own work and in your own writing, was there like this one big aha moment when suddenly, you know, your whole paradigm shifted and you started thinking about things in a different way?
Yeah. Well, you know, I've learned that those aha moments are usually, they're really comprised of many more subtle moments that sort of string together as a dawning awareness.
Hmm.
It actually makes me think of something that I heard you say at that clinic where I
Uh-oh.
Met you.
My words come back to haunt me. What
Here they
that?
Come. But
Here
you said this
come.
Thing about you think of riding a dressage test or just riding as going from one half halt to the next.
Right.
And I think that these aha moments are sort of like that. There's a buildup of a few sort of awarenesses, dawning realizations, and then something occurs to you that seems very obvious.
Hmm.
And I do remember this moment that, you know, comes to mind, although I think it was a growing awareness, as I said. I had just gotten off one of my horses, Trooper, who is learning stuff, and he was not as good as he was earlier in the week. But he was good, and I could tell that he was trying. There was a lot going on in the ring. There was a lot going on with the weather. And I remember thinking, you know, he wasn't perfect, but he really tried. And that's all we could ask. And a light bulb went off for me because I thought, my gosh, I do that to myself. I'm so want to do things right. I try so damn hard. And I realized I'm not a robot either. I should cut myself that same slack that I cut my horse.
Yeah.
And it was such a beautiful moment for me. And I think my relationship with him changed, I think, forever after that moment.
Yeah. You know, what that sort of reminds me of, this was years ago when my friend Sue Blinks, who was trying out for the Olympics in Sydney at the time, and she was having some of her own challenges. And I had a relationship with Janet Edgett, who's a psychotherapist. I don't know if you know her or not. She's in Pennsylvania. She and her husband are both psychotherapists. So Sue and I flew up together from Florida and did like double sessions because I thought, as long as we're coming all that way, let's do that.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was surprising the things that came out of it for me. And one of the things, it was kind of an aha moment, and I actually used this in a lesson that I gave to somebody yesterday who was concerned because her horse tossed his head up in the air. And I'm like, hey, you know, don't worry about it. Training is messy. Sometimes training is messy, and that's okay. It doesn't have to be perfect. And what Janet had taught me, because I said to her, one of my challenges is when I go to a horse show, in my mind, it's a performance, it's a finished product, so the more spectators there, the better. But for the most part, I like to train in private. And I've always said, well, you know, I don't want distractions, blah, 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 blah. But the truth is, sometimes, and a lot of times actually, training is messy, and you make all these mistakes, and the horse makes mistakes. And she said, Jane, you don't want people to see you not being perfect, like you expect yourself to be when you go to a competition.
Yeah.
And you have to realize that training is messy and give yourself permission to be messy and give yourself permission to make mistakes. And I have to tell you, James, that was so freeing for me. And so, you know, I use that in my own riding, but like I said, I just used it yesterday in a lesson with somebody. And as soon as I said that to her, she like took a breath and she said, oh, okay. You know, and she just carried on with what she was doing, and things got better more quickly, I'm sure, than if she had been frantic about the fact that her horse had thrown his head up in the air and she had to get his head down.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's
Isn't that
beautiful.
Cool? Yeah.
It really is. You know, it makes me think of a recent session that I did with this, you know, very sort of powerful businesswoman, and we were working on some grief issues, and we went into the round pen. Some of the work is in the round pen with a horse, and it's unstructured, at least this one was, because you can kind of get into the deeper clinical stuff. And she was, like you were saying, very aware of feeling, you know, feeling me watch her and feeling like she needed to perform.
Mm-hmm.
And it was very hard for her to sort of let go and be, just be with the horse.
Right.
And this is the beauty of this work, because this horse, who is, you know, I have the blessing of working with a herd of fantastic horses. And this horse was, you know, an upper-level eventing horse, an athlete, super smart. And he wanted nothing to do with her at all when she was all into her performance.
Wow.
And when she let go, so he said, well, you know, what's going on for you? We talked about it. When she said, well, I feel like I'm performing, I said, well, why don't you just relate to him? Why don't you just be yourself and relate to him? She found that spot in herself, and he came right over to her.
Oh, my God, you just gave me goosebumps.
He came right over to her, and they related in such a powerful way, and then she would get self-conscious again, and he would immediately stiffen up and move away. And he was clearly, he didn't trust her unless she was authentic with him. And when she was, he gave her, and she was, tears in her eyes, was like a huge moment for her. And she realized, well, you know, people will actually, beings can actually love me just for me, not for my performance. It was a powerful moment.
Yeah. Tell me more about this authentic self. I mean, how do I go about realizing what my authentic self is?
Yeah. Well, you know, the idea of authentic self is something that is so important in my work. That said, there is no single authentic self. Obviously, we have many selves, and we can't always be authentic in the world. So we need to have some defenses, otherwise we'd go, it'd be like not having any skin. But to the degree we can be as authentic as possible, I think we can be as happy as possible. I think this is where the Zen comes in for me, in that kind of being true to yourself. So the authentic self, you probably can think of moments where you feel kind of most Jane, where you feel kind of like, I am confident in who I am, I feel myself, I trust myself. And my feelings are like this. Now, over time, you know, as kids, we learn very quickly that we can't really be authentic. And we actually get rewarded when we conform and sort of behave by what we think people want for us.
Right.
The horses, I think, don't really like that. I think the horses become sort of suspicious when they feel are being inauthentic. And Linda Kahanov wrote a lot about this in the Tao of Equus, that the horses get a little afraid, and as prey animals they should. They're wondering what's being hidden here. So the horses can help us to find that place by reflecting, as they did with this woman I was just talking about, and this place where you feel most fundamentally at ease with who you are.
Wow. Yeah, you know, I think I wrote an article many years ago on horses as healers, and most of the stories that I told had to do with physical healing and how horses had helped people physically heal. But when you talk about your authentic self and the horse mirroring what you're projecting to them, I mean, they're healing you in an emotional way. Am I interpreting that the right way?
Absolutely, yeah. And what they can do, this is what gets me so excited about this work, is, you know, I've been a clinician for almost 20 years, and I have a very successful practice in New York City, and I've done the work, and I know that it really does help. Doing this work now, for as long as I've been doing it with the horses, I realize they cut right to the chase, and they can, like this, you know, I had a recent client, it was a couple, actually, that I was working with, I'll tell you about them. They flew in from England to come to see me, and I think if I had to work with them in a traditional setting, it would have taken several sessions to get where we got in a single session with the horse. Because they bring you right to that emotional center. Your defenses don't work with them. And you can't really utilize them because they don't apply. And they're not going to respond to them. They're going to respond to your honesty.
Right.
So they bypass the need, really, for me in that situation, and they can get this material up and out, and then we can work with it in a clinical setting afterwards.
Wow. Yeah. You know, that's one of the cool things about all animals, I think, as well as just horses, is that they don't lie. I mean, you know, they live in the moment. All the things that we we need to learn to do. I mean, they're such great teachers.
Gosh. Well, here's the difference with the horse, though, and because I completely agree. And we know that in animal-assisted therapy with birds or cats or dogs, we can do a whole lot. Because they're prey animals, the horse is uniquely evolved to be able to pick up cues from their environment. So the dog has evolved to please us, and they will come and respond to us. But they do have that predatory approach, whereas a horse kind of needs to be able to sense what's going on at all times.
Mm.
And so that's how they're able to mirror us so well. And they can actually respond to stuff that we may not even be aware that we're feeling at that moment. We may not be in touch with our fear or our sadness or our anger. We might think, oh, I've got my anger under control. And then the horse is all jigging around and anxious.
Yeah.
Well, what's he anxious about? Maybe he's picking up something from the person on the ground.
But how do you figure that out? I mean, how do you know whether they're picking up on anger as opposed to fear? You know.
Right. So this is what I find so exciting. So then you have the person in with the horse, and the horse is responding. Let's use this couple that I was working with. So he was very, he's rigid and kind of domineering, and he's, you know, used to controlling things. So we put him in the round pen with a mare, and his wife and I were watching from the outside. And he was trying to relate to, his assignment was to relate to the mare. So, you know, he saunters up to her, and he wants to grab her by the halter. She wants nothing to do with him. And this man rides polo. Like, he knows what he's talking. He knows how to ride a horse.
Mm-hmm.
She was not going to, she was going to relate to him, but not in any kind of comfortable way. And he had to really adjust his approach to her and change it. So as he does this, we're asking, what are you feeling? And what was that like for you when she moved over here and moved over there? And what came out from him was really important for his wife to hear. And he felt like she, the mare, he wanted to have an impact on her. He wanted her to do what he wanted her to do because he felt so powerless in the world.
Oh, my God.
And she would have never known that. And it also made her fall a little bit more in love with him to see how gentle he could actually be with this mare.
Oh, my God.
It was a side of him that she never could see. Well, he was able to identify it and talk about going to boarding school and needing to be tough in the boarding school, and that was the only way to survive. And just the feelings that came out of that were so great. Now, sometimes people do have a hard time, so the horse may jig off, and you ask the person, were you aware of what you were feeling?
Mm.
They may not be. And then you do a little bit more exercise with the horse to see, well, what happens if you behave like this?
Mm.
And sometimes when you come out of a feeling, you can identify what the feeling was that you just left.
Wow. I mean, I just think that's amazing that man was able to identify that and just articulate it. That's a really deep thing, I think, that he came
really
up with.
Really deep thing. And I genuinely don't think he would have given me that in a session in the first time. It's the first time I ever met him. But I think when you're around the horses, you know, and they, you know, the heart math, I don't know if you know the heart math people and the electromagnetic fields around the heart. Apparently the horses' field is much greater than ours. So when we're around them, our feelings come up to the surface a little more quickly. And again, because the defenses are down, people get to feelings a lot quicker.
Oh, my God. This is so fascinating. I can't even believe it. That's just amazing.
Yeah. I mean, it's there's a lot of ways to look at why the horse brings up our feelings. I mean, because they're so big. But there is some thinking, I don't know if you know the work of Candace Pert, talks about kind of the molecules of emotion, and she talks about, you know, feelings are really just our chemical states, and we have a sort of a lock. The way that we experience a feeling is really according to her, is a kind of a movement of molecules that one fits into another like a lock and a key.
Mm.
And there's iron in these cells, and and she thinks that we feel things not just in where we think our brain is, but in our heart or in our body, and feelings like that. She thinks that there are more receptor sites for feeling in spleen, for example, than in the front of your brain.
Wow.
So the thinking is, if when you're around the horse who has this huge electromagnetic field, which is something crazy like 20 times greater than that of the human being, there might be something chemical that's going on that actually brings our feelings closer to the surface just by stepping into their field.
Yeah.
The analogy would be if a human were going to be holding a cat in its arms, being in the horse's field is where the cat and they're the human, that proportionality.
Huh.
And this is why some people, as soon as they get near a horse, they're terrified.
Yes.
So they may be carrying around a lot of fear in their life, and it gets projected on the horse. Or people who want that joy and don't have it, and then they get near the horse and they feel joyful. Well, there's a part of them that really wants to experience the joy, and now here's a chance to let that out.
That's
and
amazing.
In this field, we can actually harness that and use it to help heal people. And this is why I call it the natural evolution of the horse-human bond, because I think this is where horses are taking us now.
Yeah. You know, and I can think of situations. I can think of one person in particular who, because of some of her physical issues, fibromyalgia and some other things, hasn't been able to ride for a while, but she so needs to be around the horses. She needs to smell them. She needs to touch them, you know. But the other thing that I was thinking of, as far as I have another student that has some anger issues, and of course that shows up in her riding.
Of course.
Yeah. And it never occurred to me, because I always think that you're riding, I think maybe I have it backwards based on what you're saying. I always think that your riding is kind of like a microcosm of what's going on in the rest of your life. But it sounds like, and correct me if I'm misinterpreting this, that the anger is there, and because of the vibrations of the electrical energy or whatever, I don't know the exact scientific terms, the anger that's already buried within her is brought to the surface. And that's why I see it when she's on a horse. But she's very good at masking it when she's in, like, social situations. That you would never know she was an angry person in a social situation. But the second she's sitting on a horse, you know she's an angry person.
It comes out, yeah.
Yeah.
And I think we've seen that what happens with people, like, it happens. And I think that's why it is such a microcosm, because I think both points are actually very accurate. It becomes a microcosm because it brings out all those dynamics that you can't hide.
Right.
And this is one of the things I love to do with people is watch them in a lesson and work with that. So, like, people might send me a video of them in a lesson, and we can actually work on some of the issues that might be at play, examining what goes on for them.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, with this woman and the anger on the horse, is that something that comes up in the lesson? Is that discussed at all?
Oh, yeah.
It is.
For years.
And does she identify anything around that? Is she able to?
Oh, yeah. We know where it comes from. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and she's working on it. We know where it comes. Well, right up your alley, it comes from a trauma. It comes from a really, really serious trauma that occurred when she was quite young, actually.
Mm-hmm. You know, there's a saying in this work that, you know, trauma survivors are drawn to the horse, and once they're on their back, it comes out whether they want to or not. And so this is an incredible healing opportunity, I think. And as someone who's, you know, taught trauma, as I said, I got a Fulbright Award to because of my work in the field around this, in this area. And I'm trained in eye movement desensitization and reprocessing, a whole bunch of other things. I'm feeling very strongly that the horses have the potential to heal even greater than anything I've done up till now.
Wow. It's just exciting when you think of the possibilities for the future as you explore this more and more.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I think we're just getting the taste of it. And this is why at the NARA conference, the North American Riding for the Handicapped, they're looking at now, they've been in business for 40 years. They have the Equine Facilitated Mental Health Association that's been a sort of a subdivision. And they're actually going to change their name. They're joining those two things because they're starting to realize that when we work with the horses in this way, it becomes therapeutic.
And you know, not only physically, once again, I'm thinking about the emotional thing. Very recently put out a program called Freedom from Fear, and that's maybe not the best word for it, but you know, because fear is such a big issue with riders, partially because, you know, here's this huge reactive animal that you know, doesn't function through logic like we for the most part do. You know, they're reactive, they're prey animals, like you say, and they are so large and blah, blah, blah. And then sometimes people get bucked off and they get hurt, and then all these fear issues come up because of that. So as I was putting the program together, I came up with all the different fears that I could relate to myself and had experience with, either through my own stuff or through my students. But what I did is I sent out an email just prior to finishing up, and I said, look, this is what I've done, this is what I've covered, let me know, you know, just send me a quick email and just, you know, let me know what your greatest fear is. I want to
know. I remember that email. Yeah.
Oh, you do? Okay. Oh, yeah. Well, I have to tell you, within less than a day, less than 24 hours, I had 1,200 emails.
Wow.
Yeah, it was amazing. So the question that I want to ask you, because this is one thing that I hadn't actually covered in that, is how, with the work that you do, how would strengthening the bond that we have with our horses help us deal with the fears that we have?
It's a great question. You know, Jen, I love your work, and I love Freedom from Fear. I just think it's just great what you've done with it. And I think it really is great for people to have that. So I think that you've covered some great stuff with this. And what I might add to it is that, you know, when you join up, because we have an incredible opportunity for intimacy with the horse as a herd animal feels safer when it mm-hmm. feels connected. And I think we feel safer when we're connected. So the bond can actually produce a reduction in fear.
Right.
Now, that's hard for someone who's fallen off or mm-hmm. is just afraid of the horse. So practically speaking, if we're working with somebody who's not a rider or who's a dead beginner, just being around the horse and interacting with it, grooming with it, mm-hmm. grooming it, kind of moving it around, being on the ground with it, already creates a bond that will reduce fear.
Hmm.
Now, for the rider, we have an opportunity to look at, and I have a relatively new client who came to see me after she was terribly afraid of her horse and was thinking about getting rid of it because it had bolted on her more than once. What we got to around that fear was, yes, it's the fear because the horse is bolted, which is a practical fear.
Mm-hmm.
And yet there's some other things underneath. So we're looking at sense of being out of control
mm-hmm.
or sense of feeling like you don't have the power to change what's going on in your life at that moment. So let's work with that, for example. So if we have those two fears, then working with the horse about, well, how can you be in control with the horse, which is, I think, a beautiful thing because on some level it is – you can't ever be totally in control. Things can happen. The horse can spook. So we have to recognize that you can only be in control enough.
Mm-hmm. Enough. Yeah.
Enough. Now, for some people, that is a big relief because we think of being in control is in being in control at all times in every moment.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So we learn, and how we conquer fear is to create safety by recognizing that even if we're in a situation that isn't comfortable, can we make it comfortable? Mm. And we can if we stay connected to the horse.
Mm.
So we come back to that sense of intimacy with the horse. Do I trust my horse?
Mm.
So the fear might lead to the sense of, oh, I feel out of control. Work on the control issue. And then underneath that is, I don't actually trust my horse.
Mm.
And I don't trust myself to keep myself safe. And then what we really have is not a fear issue, but a basic sense of trust issue.
Mm. Wow.
And there we get, well, again, here's the intimacy with the horse. Can we establish trust with the horse? You know, the thing about horses is if you give them trust, they'll give it to you back.
Mm-hmm.
So the person then learns to hopefully give the trust, even if it's tentative at first. They get it back, and they give it again, and it creates this thing that a horse can give us, which is a biofeedback loop, where mm-hmm. I can now begin to feel, as I relax, he relaxes. Let me relax a little bit more. Okay, maybe I can trust him. Right?
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, for myself personally, I mean, I love all of that, and I've actually seen all of that with some of my students. But let me tell you, just bringing up a couple of the points that you mentioned, how I use it for myself as far as strengthening the bond, strengthening the relationship, the fact that you said that, you know, horses feel safer in a herd and with a herd leader. If I'm on a horse that's particularly insecure,
mm-hmm.
and they can express that insecurity by shying or bolting or spinning or wheeling or whatever, I have sort of a mantra that I say. I take over the role as the herd leader, and it's my job as the protector. And so I say to the horse, I will keep you safe. I will keep you safe. That's my mantra. So as soon as I take on that role as the benign leader, then my horse thinks, well, I don't have to be on the lookout for that cougar behind the rock,
right.
because she's taking care of it for me because she's going to keep me safe.
Mm.
So that's one way that I feel, you know, taking on that role of, yes, I noticed that thing over there, but it's okay because I did notice it. I'll keep you safe. You don't have to worry. That's one
yeah.
of the ways that I've been able to strengthen the bond with the horses that I've dealt with.
And I bet that increases your own confidence or your student's confidence as well, because now you've reassured the horse, but you're also when you're saying, I will keep you safe, you're also reassuring yourself.
Mm-hmm.
You're saying, I have the ability to keep
yeah.
us both safe.
Yeah.
And the more you say it, it's like a mantra, the more you say it to yourself, the more you're going to trust that for you.
Right. Yeah, that's cool. It's just amazing work that you're doing. So how do you deal? I mean, you know, you've been doing this for a long time, and I've been teaching for over 3 decades.
Wow.
And too much over 3 decades, actually. But I won't tell you just how much. But anyhow.
That's why you're so good at it and why we love you so much, Jamie.
Oh, you're so
listen
cute.
To you forever.
Oh, you're so funny. But, you know, I have learned, I mean, I think even after over 3 decades, I think that I'm always learning how to be a better teacher. And I'm learning how to be a better teacher for a couple of reasons. I listen to the horses and the horses teach me. But I realized as I was teaching different people over the years that although primarily people seem to learn visually, there was a certain percentage of my students that had different learning styles, that some were kinesthetic, they had to feel things, or some, you know, in a shoulder in, for example, that because they were auditory learners, they had to focus on hearing the regularity of the rhythm of the footfalls. I've had people that were severely dyslexic, and I had to actually get out a pad of paper and a pen and draw things out or have them follow me around on foot. You know, I just had to become more and more creative with my teaching because different riders have obviously different learning styles. So how do you, with your work, blend the riding styles of your student, the teacher, and the horse?
Well, that's a great question, and, you know, it's just it's really on my mind because I was just having a conversation about this with my former trainer. So we were talking about one of my horses is very different than my other horse, and I find that when I ride a lot of different horses, I actually ride better. And we were talking about a mutual friend who the reverse is actually true. He finds it a lot harder if he rides different horses. It's better for him if he rides one horse a lot and then another horse. And my former trainer said to me, well, it's because you think. You're always thinking about it, and so you can actually think the application from one horse to the next, where he's more in his body and feeling things. And so he'll feel it in one horse, but then he gets on another horse, and where's that feeling? It feels very different on this horse.
Yeah.
And it confuses him to go back up into the head and start to think about things. So here's where my overthinking actually is a benefit. In equine energetics, we actually look at learning styles quite a lot, and we had recently a workshop called Learning Styles in the Rider where we looked at the Kolb Learning Style Inventory. I don't know if you know that.
No, I don't.
One, it's quite good. We use it, you can use it, it's traditionally used also in executive coaching or business settings. And it looks at 4 different types of learning styles. And in equine energetics, we actually can administer the test and look at what style you fit into. So, you know, your style, as you described it, would be a converging style, and that's somebody who is able to be open to new ideas, to look at research, but also to take hands-on and to take a creative approach of applying it to their student.
Hmm.
Whereas someone else might be like, the diverging style is somebody who learns best by observing rather than actually taking an action. So this might be somebody who does better, for example, by auditing a bunch of classes or watching other writers than by doing it. Now, some people, like the accommodating style is another one, is somebody who really needs to have a hands-on approach. They don't want to read the book. They don't want to watch anyone else ride. They want to get on the horse and they want to do it themselves, and that's how they're going to learn best.
Hmm.
And I think to the degree that you're aware of the style that is most most representative of who you are, then you're going to be able to find the horse and the teacher who's going to be able to help harness that energy and use it to your benefit. Because I think too often, you know, I love when you said you're really open to learning and learning from the horses, because I think too often people think, especially with learning to ride, that there is a way to do it and this is how it's going to be.
Mm.
And then you get into this, as a student, you can feel very frustrated. Well, I'm not getting it. There must be something wrong with me.
Right.
Well, no, actually, it may not be something wrong with you. It may be just that that style doesn't fit who you are. Another style might fit better with someone else. And again, I think that's what makes you such a great trainer and teacher, Jane, is because, you know, even just watching the DVDs that you have, you can see that you give enough material, but enough openness and opportunity for people to interpret what you're saying. So you never tell people it's always like this. There's a fluidity in the way that you teach that I think allows a number of styles to benefit from how you teach.
Wow, that's great. I didn't know that.
Yes, I've been studying this. You came up in the Learning Styles workshop because I was quoting from your Happy Horse DVD.
Oh, cool.
And saying, you know, like there's an alphabet and there's phrases and we're learning vocabulary.
Yeah.
And
I knew my ears were burning. There you go. Yeah. You know what? Now tell me this, because since you're a psychotherapist, so you would know this kind of stuff. And, you know, I'm a layman. I just sort of do these things instinctively. But one of the things, talk about different learning styles, and having had a lot of experience in breaking things down so that people can understand and apply it, one of the things that I rarely do, and our mutual friends could probably tell you this, is that in clinics, I don't ride the horses.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the reasons, well, I have two reasons for not riding the horses. I know that I can ride from the ground and I can talk somebody through the whole process, as opposed to getting on the horse, putting the horse in a certain position, putting the rider back on, letting them feel it, and having them think, well, having them think two things. Number one, well, that was great, but how do I go from point A to point B? I don't know what came in the middle to do that. But also, I think, and maybe it's because it's happened to me. It has happened to me. I'll tell you, now that I thought of that, I just had an aha moment of when it happened to me. I think that, and maybe I'm completely wrong about this. You feel free to tell me, but if I'm completely wrong about this. But I think that when you say to a student, get off, I'll show you, blah, 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 you're sending a very subtle message to them that they're not capable, that they're inadequate, that they're less than, that they're not capable, that they're not enough. And I'll tell you, and it really, it just popped into my mind at this moment. I remember, and I was really relatively experienced at this point, that I was training with someone and I was working over the course of weeks on a particular issue with a horse that I had. And so she said, listen, I need to put more than a day together. Let me just ride him for the next week or two and work on this. And I said, fine, and I would just watch. So after 10 days or 2 weeks, she said, okay, you can get on and just walk him around. But whatever you do, don't pick up the contact. Just walk him on a loose rein. And I thought to myself, oh, my God, I'm such a terrible rider that if all I do is pick up contact with this horse's mouth, I'm going to destroy everything that she's created in 2 weeks. And so that was my interpretation of whatever you do, don't pick up the reins, which is why I'm very, very sensitive to if there's any way, shape, or form that I can talk a student through the steps to produce the finished product, I prefer to do that than to get on the horse and show them. And, of course, obviously I'm bringing my own issues to that, you know, that I was made, and not purposely, but I was made to feel inadequate, and I never want to do that to another student.
Yeah. Well, you know, again, this is what makes you a great teacher, because you're able to acknowledge these things and to see them. And I think that is, I mean, that's how we develop confidence, is we're able to look at the stuff that hurts us, our vulnerabilities. You know, I do think that occasionally, if a trainer or teacher sets up the horse for the student, then the student can get on and feel it in their body in a way so that there's a muscle memory version that goes on when you're actually able to feel it without doing it. But I completely agree with what you're saying, in that it not only sends a message that we can't possibly control for, so we don't know how the person's going to interpret it, like I may be less than, oh, I'll never get it, the person's impatient with me, they're going to be mean to my horse. But ultimately, it breaks the intimacy bond between the student and their horse in that moment. So that all the stuff we were talking about creating that bond and maintaining that bond and safety and all that stuff, it's going to throw all that up in the air, because now you're saying, I can't keep my horse. I can't do this with my horse. And then you're thinking, Micah, well, I can't keep my horse safe. Well, then I can't think myself. I can't make myself safe.
Mm-hmm.
Well, then now I have fear. And what if I'm on my own and the teacher's not here to get on? Will I be able to do this? And so you do create this self-doubt that comes, I think, from, as you're pointing out, the very genesis of breaking that bond of intimacy between the person and the horse when the teacher gets on.
Yeah. Although I agree with you, there is value. I mean, I remember. There is value in the trainer getting on the horse and you getting on and feeling something that you've never felt before so that you know the feeling you're trying to recreate. I remember working with Herbert Rabein in Germany and having some challenges with the canter pirouette with my horse, and he got on and, you know, I couldn't see him do anything extraordinary, but he just did these, like, awesome pirouettes. But the amazing thing was I got back on, and the base of my horse's neck was, like, probably 8 inches wider. I mean, talk about being put through, and I hadn't seen him do anything dramatic. And I'm like, oh, my God. I didn't realize that there was this whole other layer of throughness, of connection, that I needed to create. And he was obviously a brilliant, brilliant rider and trainer, but he was not a very good teacher. He was, you know, he just couldn't articulate. I mean, I would ask him how he'd do things, and he'd shrug his shoulders and go, oh, it's just riding. And I'm like, yeah, easy for you to say.
Right. How does that help me? Right.
Yeah, really. But I did have a chance to see that, to feel that, and then I had something that I could sort of search and find to try to recreate that on my own and sort of stumble through it, and I was able to find it. So I totally agree that there is value in that. I think I'm just more sensitive because of my own issues of hurting or destroying a rider's confidence, because I know how important that confidence is to being able to ride well. Even if you're evenly matched skill for skill, if you've lost your confidence, you're not going to ride as well as somebody who's feeling confident about themselves.
And then the horse won't feel confident.
Right, exactly.
You know, there's so much that, you know, if I think that setting up could be used in limited doses and with profound discretion, I think it could be a tool.
Yeah.
But I think it can easily be overused as well.
Yeah. Well, notice I said in clinics, because I only see people for 2 days in a clinic. It's a different thing if someone's in regular training with me and I have a long history and I'm not worried that after 2 days I'm going to leave and leave them with the wrong message.
So
there's a different teaching dynamic that goes with a clinic as opposed to a regular student that I, you know, see on a regular basis like that.
Yeah, I think that's an important distinction, because I think when people come for a clinic, they're also poised. There is that performance piece of it.
Mm-hmm.
you know, and for you to, you know, of course, everyone wants James Avoy to ride their horse. I would love it. At the same time, it's probably the sense of, you know, I want her to see me on my horse.
Right.
And if you were to get on, I totally get what you're saying. It could easily communicate impatience, or you're clearly not getting it, and
right.
So I'm going to do it for you.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, like I said, I'm always learning as a rider, and I have old established habits that I revert to and some common patterns that I fall into. And sometimes, well, most of the time, I need somebody on the ground to tell me that I'm doing these things because I'm not even aware. What would you suggest to riders as far as being able to recognize some of the common patterns that they fall into and how to overcome them?
Well, you know, it depends on, you know, what the pattern, what kind of pattern it is. So I think that there's, what comes to mind to me is there's patterns of relating, and then there's patterns of thinking, let's say. So in the patterns of relating, I would think the things that jump out at me are when people relate to their horse in an adversarial way.
Mm-hmm.
So it's when you mm-hmm. feel like the horse's behavior is, you're going to take it personally.
Right.
So he's taking advantage of me, or the trainer says, don't let them get away with that. So that's one pattern that I think is, to me, the kind of the worst one with the horses, because the horse isn't, I don't think the horse thinks that way. And so you're projecting all your stuff onto the horse,
mm-hmm.
and you can't possibly get out of that. Like, that's a never-ending cycle right there, because the horse is going to continue to give you back what you've been giving them, which is this adversarial relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And so if that person can identify that they're doing that and try a different approach, which is a joining up or bonding, that could easily break that pattern.
Hmm.
But again, if it's a pattern of thinking, I don't know if this is what you're referring to, but a pattern of all the negative self-talk that comes
right.
up for some people when they're riding, like, I can't do this, you're so stupid, you've never been able to learn.
Yeah.
Look at that person can get it so quickly, why can't I? All the thinking in there will clearly be either projected onto the horse, or the horse will be as seen as the reason why they're feeling that. So it's going to bring up a whole lot of emotion around that. So if you can look at the pattern and see what it is the first step. Just identify it, become
mm-hmm.
aware of it. And then after that, what we try to do is to look at its metaphor, like look where else this is playing out in the person's life.
Mm.
So if it's, I'm just not getting this, I'm not coordinated, I'll think, what does that mean about you? That, well, I'm not coordinated, never been coordinated, I was, I don't know, bad at sports as a kid. Well, then let's look at what that means about you in life in general. Well, I don't try new things because I'm afraid.
Hmm.
And so we look at, what's the fear about? Humiliation. Well, I'm afraid I'm going to be embarrassed in front of people. Well, so now we have number of patterns of behavior that start from the sense of, I'm afraid of being embarrassed.
Mm.
So here's somebody who needs to kind of work with issues around shame or embarrassment and building confidence. And so we come right back to the horse riding, because what could possibly be better for that than actually horse riding? And I think, I see this with my patients. I think, gosh, if only you rode, we could work on this stuff right here, because it could get you to make, you know, to concentrate on that 20-meter circle, and however long it takes you to get it, you'll get it, and break this pattern of I can't do it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That reminded me of this student that I had, and it was just such a shock to me, because I could look at her very, very objectively, and she's just an amazing person. She's smart, and she's funny, and she's athletic, and she's talented. I mean, she's really a gifted person, a gifted athlete, and a gifted rider. And one day she said to me that she sees herself as below average. She said, I see myself as below average. And my jaw just fell on the ground.
Wow.
And I'm like, you're one of the least below average people I think I know in my life. What are you talking about? And then she started relating all these things in her history about when in school she thought she was below average, just all these different areas that she thought she was below average. It was just really fascinating. And she brought that, of course, to her writing as well.
And you can see that pattern. She probably tried really hard and was probably, I would say, trying to do the best she could be, almost to the point of perfectionism, but was not able to get the nourishment of a good job well done because it rested on this paradigm where she's not good enough.
And that reminds me of somebody different, but she said this other person said a very, very sad thing to me. This was many years ago, and this was also a top writer. She said, I know when I die, the epitaph on my gravestone is going to read, she was not content.
Wow.
Really, really sad. But, you know, that kind of perfectionism and just never quite living up to your own expectations. And, it's just amazing. But we don't have a lot of time left, and I want to shift gears because I think it's all fascinating how you're using horses as healers, but flip it around here for me and tell me about some of the work that you're doing with, you know, helping horses that have had some kind of trauma in their lives.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, it's so important to me, and this is actually what kicked off the entire equine energetics, I'll tell you, is that it was my horse, and my trainer was riding my horse in one of those moments we were just describing, and my horse Trooper was just giving my trainer a hard time. And I thought, you know, why are you doing this? And my trainer got off and said, well, you know, it's like he goes somewhere else. It's like he checks out and he's in a totally other place. And a light bulb went off for me. And I thought, coming back to this aha moment, I thought, holy, this is what happens when traumatized people go into a dissociative state. I thought, I'm a trauma specialist. I should be able to figure out something to do with this. And oddly, it's an odd story. That day, the chiropractor, Rosemary Ganser, was working on my horse, and she said, you know, you're a trauma specialist. Have you ever heard of this eye movement desensitization and reprocessing? And I said, well, actually, yeah, I've been doing it for many years. And she said, there are people who are starting to use it on horses.
Wow.
Wow, this is crazy. I'd love to do it. So immediately, I started tapping on my horse. He very quickly relaxed. And I talked to some other people who, you know.
And were you tapping up by his ears? Was it like alternate tapping by his ears?
In EMDR, what we do is it's bilateral stimulation.
Yep,
so
right.
You use sound or touch or sight. So I started just right on, just below his eyes. In that flat part where the cheekbone comes out. And he really loved it. So I looked around, saw what people were doing around it, and realized this is totally new. I'm going to apply what I know to the horses. And actually worked on one horse who was up for sale when I started working on him, because probably one of the most intelligent horses I've met, but he was unpredictable. He had thrown the rider a couple of times. She'd gotten hurt. And we did bilateral tapping on him over a course of three sessions. And by the third session, he had changed so dramatically that she took him off the market.
Oh, my God.
She's totally safe and comfortable on him. And I actually gave a recent lecture with Vera Paisner Miller, who had done an article for Dressage Today about EMDR for riders, and we actually presented on this for the horse and rider.
Wow.
So we can use it, for example, in the therapeutic riding programs. We do know that the horses who work with the autistic children or the handicapped kids will sometimes get overwhelmed or burnt out themselves. So we could use it for them because it actually has a soothing ability. But we can also help eliminate some scary or negative habits, everything from, you know, girthiness to shyness around blankets, if there's any kind of phobia. We actually apply it to the horse, and it's, again, it's about 3 to 5 sessions. And it's pretty amazing stuff. We're seeing incredible results. And we know that, for example, in humans, it is the most well-documented psychotherapeutic approach right now. And its efficacy has been so well-documented that obviously insurance companies love it because it's quick, it's short, and it gets the job done.
Yeah.
And I'm seeing with my work with the horses that it actually applies just as well to equines as it does for humans.
You're blowing my mind, I want you to know. I mean, this is like, not for both the riders and the horses, this is absolutely the most fascinating thing I have ever heard. I mean, this is just amazing. And so I'm sure that people want to know more about this. So, like, do you have a website or a way that people can contact you and find out where you are, what your schedule is, what you're doing?
Sure. We have, you know, we have, I offer tailored sessions to people that are brief treatments. So they could be a couple of hours, a whole day long. We have one-day workshops on everything from working with creativity to, as I said, learning styles. We do team management, team building. We do stuff for our businesses. We do long weekend workshops as well. We did one with Kathleen Ingram, who was also one of the founders of the Tao of Equus. And we do all sorts of things. And you can find our information on equineenergetics.com, and that's one word. So it's equineenergetics with an X at the end, .com. Or you can just call me at 212-477-4475. Or you can actually write to us at Equine Energetics, P.O. Box 282, and that's in Wacabuck, and that's WACCABUC, New York. And
wow.
That's, 10597.
Cool.
So go to the website, check it out. There's lots
yeah.
of information on there, links to some other exciting places. And Jane, I so appreciate your time. I love
talking
to you.
Oh, I appreciate your time. I know what your schedule is like. And like I said, I'm completely blown away, fascinated. I need to learn more about this, and maybe we can connect when I'm in New York again. It's just amazing. You're doing great, great work.
Thank you so much. Yeah, come up to, you know, we're housed up in Mistover Farm. We go to different barns. We can go wherever. If people want to host us someplace,
yeah.
we're happy to go, and we've done that, certainly. But our herd is based at Mistover, which is in Pawling, New York. It's a gorgeous facility,
mm-hmm.
come, as you know.
Yeah.
So we'd love to have you join us.
Great. All right. Well, James, thank you so much, and I'll be talking or seeing you soon.
I'd love that. All right. You take care.
Okay. Bye-bye.
The moderator has left the conference.